Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate
Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Srimad Bhagavatam, 4th Canto, Chapter 30, The Activities of the Prachetas, Text 47. Tatra Vishistaye Vriksha Bita Duhitaram Tara Ujjahushte Prachetobhya Upadishta Swayam Bhuva Tatra Vishistaye Vriksha Bita Duhitaram Tara Ujjahrushte Prachetobhya Upadishta Swayam Bhuva Tatha Vishishtaye Vriksha Bita Duhitaram Tara Ujjahrushte Prachetobhya Upadishta Swayam Bhuva Vaishnavis. Tatra, there, avashishta, remaining, ye, which, riksha, trees, pita, being afraid, duittaram, their daughter, tada, at that time, ujjahu, delivered, te, they, Prachetobhya, unto the Prachetas, Upadishta, being advised, Swayambhuva by Lord Brahma. Translation. The remaining trees, being very much afraid of the Prachetas, immediately delivered their daughter at the advice of Lord Brahma. Purport. The daughter of the trees is referred to in text 13 of this chapter. This daughter was born of Kandu and Pramlocha. The society girl, Pramlocha, after giving birth to the child, immediately left for the heavenly kingdom. While the child was crying, the king of the moon took compassion upon her and saved her by putting his finger in her mouth. This child was cared for by the trees. When she grew up, by the order of Lord Brahma, she was delivered to the Prachetas as their wife. The name of the girl was Madisha, as the next verse will explain. It was the predominating deity of the trees that delivered the daughter. In this connection, Srila Jiva Goswami Prabhupada states, Vrikshatad Adhisthatri Devata. The trees means the controlling deity of those trees. In Vedic literature, we find there's a controlling deity of the water. Similarly, there's a controlling deity of the trees. The Prachetas were engaged in burning all the trees to ashes, and they considered the trees their enemies. To pacify the Prachetas, the predominating deity of the trees, under the advice of Lord Brahma, delivered the daughter Madisha. Om Gyanatimirandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhunitananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shivasadi Gaur Bhaktavrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. Sometimes devotees, especially younger devotees, or also older devotees in a quiet way, they become bewildered by inconceivable information in the Bhagavatam. When it's time for doubts, when it's time to re-engage in sense gratification, the fifth canto is a great excuse. How can we understand this? It has no correlation to the scientific information available today. But why simply go to the fifth canto and pick on that? The whole Bhagavatam is inconceivable. But to speak of Bhagavad Gita. Here, just think. You have gathered here at this early hour of the morning from the materialist point of view. And what are you hearing? You're sitting on the floor. And what are you listening to? You're hearing about the daughter of the trees. The society girl, Pramlocha, after giving birth to the child, immediately left for the heavenly kingdom. While the child was crying, the king of the moon took compassion upon her and saved her by putting his finger in her mouth. This child was cared for by the trees. And when she grew up, by the order of Brahma, she was delivered to the Prachetas as their wife. There's no way around it. On every page of Bhagavatam, there's information beyond the range of our current senses. Bhagavatam is a challenge. But it's the most beautiful and most heartwarming and indeed intellectually satisfying challenge, because every word in Srimad Bhagavatam is meant to arouse ecstatic love of Krishna. For example, the fifth canto. Srila Prabhupada explained that Shukadeva Goswami's main purpose is to arouse ecstatic love of Krishna. In the course of his arousing ecstatic love of Krishna in the audience, he's talking about the universe. He gives some basic points. But these basic points are, for the most part, beyond the range of our experience. We shouldn't lose sight of Shukadeva Goswami's main purpose, which is to convey ecstatic love of Krishna. In the course of his presenting that ecstatic love, He describes things that connect to our current sensory reality in a very controversial way. But, as I said, the whole Bhagavatam is like that. What to speak of Bhagavad Gita? Krishna says, I spoke this knowledge thousands upon thousands of years ago to the chief living entity who lives in the fire. So, even before you get to Bhagavatam, you have enough reason to become materially arrogant and just say, this is implausible. This is impossible. When we look at the powers of living entities as yoga, then things can become more clear. Especially these days, yoga is mainstream. That is people's idea of the yoga system. They've pulled out the hatha yoga activities. They've pulled out the pranayama activities from the eightfold yoga system and sheared these aspects of the eightfold yoga system from the ultimate goal, which is to make the mind peaceful for meditating upon the Lord in the heart. Yoga doesn't simply refer to asanas. It doesn't simply refer to breathing exercises. Yoga can also be understood as power, potency. As Srila Prabhupada once explained, every living entity has some yoga power. When you see the birds flying in the air, that's yoga. You cannot fly in the air because you don't have that yoga power. When you see earthworms tunneling through the earth, eating the earth as they make their way, this is yoga power. Every creature has this, some potency, some special potency. So if you look at that potency as yoga, yoga potency, artistry, yoga artistry, then you can understand better what's going on in the universe. And you have a chance to understand Krishna, who is Yogeshvara, the master of all yoga power. So as soon as you start thinking of living entities in terms of power and potency, the Bhagavatam becomes more clear. The problem, of course, with the mundane conception of life is that power is not automatically connected to living entities. It's connected to matter. As Judah Karma Prabhu can explain much better than I. Matterism is a religion. It's faith that matter can do inconceivable things. From it comes consciousness. From it comes life. So this is religious fervor. But it's the acceptable religious fervor of mainstream, mundane society. Supposedly, you have a clear division between religion and science. Science is about testable hypotheses, and religion is about belief without evidence. How much of our existence can we understand with our present senses? We're seeing more and more trouble in the world because of a lack of knowledge that's beyond the range of our senses. Human beings have gone so far based on their ordinary sense perception, and now they're getting reactions. How great the reactions will be in terms of the environment, they can't say. In this environment of crisis, dealing with the unknown, you would think that people will become more sensitive about understanding laws of nature beyond what are currently known. It's a good time to explain to people that your problems with nature, your problems with the environment, cannot be solved on the level of your ordinary sense perception. Of course, it is true that even the solutions, the partial solutions that can be seen by ordinary senses, people can't do that. They can't eat in such a way as to have a healthy existence in nature. By their eating habits, they destroy themselves and they destroy the world. So even things that are within the range of their sense perception, solutions that are within the range of their sense perception, they can't do because they don't have the sense control. An example, earlier this year, the coordinator of the Intergovernmental Committee on Climate Change, they shared the Nobel Prize with Al Gore, he released a statement that we're afraid to say this. Your Nobel Prize winners are afraid to say this. But the fact is, the easiest way for people to deal with climate change and its threat is to deal with the meat in their diet. So we're afraid to say this. So here's something that's within the range of everyone's sense perception. It doesn't require any mystical faith in Bhagavatam. It doesn't require accepting inconceivable things. It's plain old ordinary, meat on the table. What's it doing to you? What's it doing to the environment? They can't deal with that. So if the sense control and discipline is lacking to deal with solutions within the range of our sense perception, how do you expect people to have the sensitivity to, or the humility to deal with solutions that are beyond their sense perception? Of course, material nature can shake things up to such an extent that people will be humiliated and desperate. Maybe there's something else going on beyond what we can see. Maybe we need to turn to other sources of information containing divine principles. That means principles that don't have an origin from within this material universe. Is there really something so threatening about our accepting that the universe is governed by divine principles, principles that are beyond this universe? If you ask a scientist to describe the laws of nature, the laws governing the universe, in terms of their origin, they can't say anything. Their whole pursuit of knowledge is based on an assumption, an underlying faith that the universe is rational in terms of its order, its functioning. Therefore, as a scientist, you dedicate your life to discovering these laws of the universe and applying them. If the universe is just a jumble of incoherent, unconnected elements and factors and influences, then there's no point in doing science. The whole point is that there's order in the functioning of the universe. And this order comes from very elegant, beautiful mathematical laws, which are not affected by what happens in the cosmos. Just see. We say Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, although he emanates the material world, he's not affected by the material world. But that is considered religious faith. Rejecting Krishna, you can have faith in the laws of nature. They're beyond the universe. They're not affected by what happens in the universe. No one knows their origin. They're there. And you have faith that they're there. In fact, you have faith that they apply everywhere in the universe. Law of gravity, law of electromagnetism, motion inside the atoms, it's the same everywhere. You have to have that faith. Of course, now that faith is taking a different turn, as the multi-universe theory becomes very popular. That there are countless parallel universes, multi-universes, and in some of them, the circumstances for life were just right, and therefore life appeared. But in many of them, the circumstances were not precise for life, and life didn't appear. All this happened by chance. From chance, you have laws of nature which function rationally and reasonably. You have to have this kind of faith. It is often said, if you pose the scientific question, why are there laws of nature? Why are there laws of the universe? What is their origin? Then you're dismissed. Your question is dismissed as being unscientific. You should just understand the laws are what they are. They're just there. You have to have that faith. In other words, it's not true that religion is about belief without evidence, and science, as generally known, is about the facts, the evidence, testable things. We explained Sunday, at the Sunday feast presentation, how Krishna presents process in Bhagavad Gita. Maya sakta manaparta yogam yujan marashraya. Arjuna, I'm going to give you the laboratory process, how you can know me in full, free from doubt. Your mind will end up being attached to mine in full consciousness. You can know me. Your consciousness will be attached to me. Here's the process. Just listen. I'm going to teach you. And we were explaining how we spoke at New York University a few days ago. The theme was science as faith or scientific faith. The devotees were making a contrast that what people consider science is actually so much faith, and what people consider to be faith, bhakti yoga or Krishna consciousness, actually has a scientific aspect to it in that you're offered a full program for verification. As you progress in Krishna consciousness, your senses become enhanced, and the super soul from within the heart brings about more and more illumination. You can see more, just like the sun rises in the morning and you can see what's around you. Therefore, we say that self-realization and Krishna consciousness go hand in hand. Seeing the self is done by the illumination coming from Krishna. Just like when the sun rises, you can see yourself and everything around you. Similarly, when the Krishna sun rises through the bhakti yoga process, you see yourself, you see all living entities properly, you see all the energies of the Lord as they're actually working. Therefore, Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita, yajgata na punamoham. The result of approaching a genuine representative of Krishna and inquiring submissively is that you won't be in illusion anymore. Krishna said, you'll see all living beings are in me, they're mine. You'll see how everything is connected. We like to explain, as we told the students at NYU, nowhere in Bhagavad Gita does Krishna say, believe in me. Although we're not criticizing religious belief. Always have to add that. Even Sunday here, one Indian gentleman became very disturbed. Are you trying to say that religious belief isn't what the Gita is all about? I tried to explain to him that religious belief is laudable, it's praiseworthy, but Krishna wants to give you much more than that. Krishna wants to give you enhanced experience. You see, what happens is, in a backhanded way, it's very convenient just to accept Bhagavad Gita as a belief. I believe in it, and then you don't have to practice it. And you're still okay because you believe in it. So sometimes persons have this fear that if I If I accept Bhagavad Gita as more than religious belief, the imperative will be that I have to follow it, practice it. And that's scary. It's much easier to just believe. I believe in Krishna. I believe in the Gita. I am a Hindu. I believe in the Bible. I believe in Jesus. I am a Christian. I believe in the Quran. I am a Muslim. Real Dharma, of course, means action, behavior, activities that are governed by religious principles. Bhagavatam says, Savai Pumsama Pro Dharmo Yato Bhakti Vadokshade Ahitaki Pratiyata Yidatma Supersidati. That religion is first class, as Prabhupada would always point out. The Bhagavatam doesn't say, the Hindu religion is first class, Christian religion is first class, or Muslim religion is first class. It says, no, whatever. That religion is first class if it can produce ecstatic love of God, if it can give the experience. Ecstatic love is not a belief. Often, just to kind of shake people a bit, I give them the example about ordinary relationships within the material world. I point to a couple, and I say to the man, suppose you told your wife, you know, I believe that you're my wife. I mean, would that really do something big? Is that enormous impact? I believe that we're married. I believe you're my wife. It was like, so what? She wants to know, what are you going to do? Where's the service? Where's the attachment? Where's the talking and the gifts and the fulfilling of desires? What's your program for that? He said, no, I believe in you. I believe that we're married. I believe that you're the wife. There's just nothing to it. There'll probably be a divorce the next day. In other words, relationships are founded on dynamic exchange. Experience, not belief. Although belief is something. We have to be a little careful not to criticize religious belief, but we should put it in its perspective. In any worthwhile activity, some faith is required just to get your foot in the door. So Krishna invites you into the bhakti laboratory. If you apply Krishna's instructions properly, you'll get the result. And this causes increased attachment for Krishna. As described earlier in this chapter, what does the super soul do for the devotee? From within the heart of the devotee, the super soul makes devotional activities eternally ever fresh. In other words, a devotee can be doing what, from the material point of view, seems to be the same service for decades. It's a good example here. Mayapur in the treasury. Decades! Yet, it's not the same thing. From the material point of view, it looks like the same thing. How can someone just do the same thing? Yeah, decade after decade. Materialists immediately think of someone just working the same job. Let's say you're a bus driver for 40 years. It sounds very unenlivening. Happiness comes from change. Expressing yourself. Changing this way, changing that way. I shouldn't talk about my immediate family because I found out now sometimes they're going on the internet and listening to my lectures. But one of my brothers, he's a doctor and he's in charge of the Mott Foundation, you know, Mott's Applesauce. They have a philanthropic foundation, so he's chairman of that. Giving medical care to children. So, I remember one One day he came to me, kind of incognito, or, you know, with tears in his eyes. The routine, I can't stand it. How did you avoid it? How did you avoid it? And he's successful. But just the routine of day after day, going to the office, coming home, going to the office, coming home, going to the clinic in his case, having all the statistics, you know, 2.2 children, 2.5 cars in the garage. The monotony was getting to him to the extent that he had tears in his eyes and dared to approach his Hare Krishna brother to confess this. To the material vision, someone who can do service, the same service in the same place, decade after decade. It's like Suvas Prabhu was telling me, how many years as temple president?
30 years.
Of course, we all know it's a blessing, but from the material point of view, I mean, what are you doing? You know, in the same place, 30 years, doing the same thing. You know, you're getting some huge salary. What's going on? You're getting lots of worship and praise? The material vision can't understand that. I was listening about the glories of Ram Dass and 15 years of head pujari. And when you're a pujari, your world is... Your physical world is very small. It's confined to the altar, the paraphernalia room, the kitchen, and back to your apartment. That's it. I remember during the intense book production days when I used to live across the street. Not simply was it intense during the Chaitanya Charitamrita marathon, but also for the remaining 2 years Prabhupada was with us. 2 or 3 years after that. Such an intense pace. BBT production had to keep up, because otherwise we knew Prabhupada would get angry. He wanted his books out quickly. So, although I lived in Los Angeles for 3 years, I knew nothing of the city. I think the only time we ever went somewhere besides crossing the street from the BBT building over there to the temple back forth, the only time we deviated from that little world was to go on Harinam. So although I lived in LA for 3 years, I don't know, I knew nothing about the city, how to get around. I never went anywhere. Our world became so self-contained and so small physically. Of course, through devotional service, the entrance to the unlimited realm opens. But anyway, how can a devotee just go on year after year doing what is apparently the same thing from external vision? The secret is explained in this chapter. The super soul in the heart makes for increasingly fresher realizations. In other words, the Lord in the heart lets you see the spiritual reality, which is ever fresh. You become increasingly aware of that. Your senses change. Your sense perception changes. It becomes enhanced, expanded. And the devotee feels satisfied and nourished because he or she is not simply getting religious belief, but actually genuine spiritual experience. We pointed out on Sunday how Albert Einstein made a very famous statement that all knowledge of reality begins with experience and ends with experience. We agree with that. It's just that we're open to Krishna's experience. The Bhagavatam is presenting you with the experience of personalities who are beyond the powers of human beings you know today. We're open to that. We're open to the experience of the Prachetas. They have more yoga power than the average human being today. Therefore, when they came out from under the ocean, they saw that trees were covering the surface of the earth. And so, they burned the trees to ashes. Because there was no agricultural production. Trees were just covering the whole earth. No food could be grown. The Prachetas are Kshatriyas. They're concerned with the benefit of the people. Therefore, they had to do something. So they began burning the trees to such an extent that Lord Brahma said, okay, enough, enough. The activity of the Prachetas gives you insight about how governments are supposed to care for people. A government is supposed to be concerned with the food production. But the way food is produced today destroys people, destroys the environment. I was at Gita Nagari 2 weeks ago, and those of you who've been there know Gita Nagari has a beautiful small river running on its border. So here you are in the middle of the countryside. Nice, isolated, peaceful, and a beautiful river running alongside. The river's polluted. Why? Because of all the fertilizer, chemical fertilizer runoff from the farms. Goes right into the river, so the river is dangerous to swim in. You're in the middle of nowhere. You're not in the city. You're not in the suburbs. You're in complete rural America, and you can't swim in a river. Because of the chemical fertilizer running off into the river from all the surrounding farmland. As people feel the pinch more and more about what they consider to be things they should get easily, like food, they're going to start to question. Right now, in the USA, only 2% of the population's directly engaged in agricultural activities. This is not the way the USA was established. It was primarily an agricultural country. For as long back as anyone can remember or historians can analyze, food, meeting the food problem was the number one challenge for all human beings. It's just that within the past 100, 150 years or so, probably less than that, maybe about 100 years, suddenly it seems the food problem is easily solved. No one needs to work on farms. Everyone can migrate to the cities, and with mechanization and chemical agriculture, the food problem is easily taken care of. It's all backfiring now. In such a crisis, people will listen more. They'll be more sensitive to hearing that there are laws of nature beyond what they recognize. If they can posit laws of nature for influencing matter, why not laws of nature governing consciousness? Why not supreme consciousness as the origin of the laws, instead of just matter or chance? In this way, you can point out, religion has aspects of science, and science has a lot of aspects of faith. So let's, instead of having a fight about it, let's just see, what's the best knowledge? What's the best system? Let's have an analysis of that. Rather than just say, you are just hung up on belief without evidence. And just because there are things in the Bhagavatam that are beyond our present range of senses, doesn't mean they're untrue. Especially since the Bhagavatam and the Gita offer you a program to verify the information, if you stick to it. That's the whole problem, if you stick to it. The Prachetas are wonderful with their stick-to-itness and determination. A group of wonderful brothers, even the Supreme Personality of Godhead, complimented them. I am so pleased by your camaraderie, how you all are united together for my service. I'm so pleased with you. That camaraderie is very tasty. when people see, when outsiders see how devotees are working together and caring for each other. They're attracted. Of course, not all of us are fortunate to have brothers who are Krishna conscious, like the Prachetas, or here you have Savas Prabhu and Naikatma Prabhu. It was such a joy seeing them in kirtan together. It's a very special thing to have biological family members who are devotees in good standing. It's pleasing. You can see that. Yeah, this is what a family is really about. The Prachetas, there were more of them. Yet, they're all united. Their brotherhood, their biological brotherhood was all united upon service to the Supreme Lord. And certainly they'll have to be very united because now they're all being told by Brahma, as well as the Lord himself, to marry the same girl. There's going to have to be definitely be a lot of cooperation. By the way, those things are not allowed in the age of Kali. So, Prabhupada explains a detail, a psychological detail. It's actually a yogic power for a woman to be able to marry more than one husband. It's a mystical potency because she has to be so competent enough to treat each husband the same. And for general female psychology, that's impossible. You know, someone's got to be the favorite. Someone's got to get more than the others. But the Vedic requirement is that in rare cases, when a woman marries more than one husband, she has to treat all of them equally. That means she's got yoga power. In any case, the system doesn't work in Kali Yuga. But we're just focusing on yoga power. Once we understand these inconceivable things in Bhagavatam as yoga power, and Krishna as Yogeshwara, the master of all yoga power, then things start to become clear. Otherwise, unconsciously, we get bewildered thinking, how can such things happen? Because unconsciously, we're ascribing, we're giving inconceivable potencies to matter. And then we think, well, how can a person do these things? Persons don't have such powers. But in a backhanded, unconscious way, you're ascribing, you're giving inconceivable powers to matter, and that's okay. Matter gives rise to consciousness. Matter gives rise to the laws of the universe. Oh, very intelligent, very rational. Very rational, logical, beautifully mathematical laws come out of non-reason and irrationality. Just by hearing Bhagavatam, our awareness of the material world and spiritual world constantly increases because of the super soul in the heart. And therefore a devotee can hear these things and not blink an eye. And that often upsets non-devotees. How can you just sit on the floor and listen to this? The daughter of the trees, nourished by the moon god who stuck his finger in her mouth. You can sit here and listen to that because your senses have changed. Your experience has changed. And we invite everyone to this program of enhancing sense perception, changing experience. That is Lord Chaitanya's Sankirtan movement. Let everyone enter the bhakti laboratory. Let everyone start the process of sensory enhancement. All right, we'll stop here and ask if any questions, comments.
Hi, Balmaran.
Yes.
Thank you very much for a nice presentation. But there has to be obviously some counter argument to what you're presenting here. For instance, the scientists could say, yes, we start our beliefs, but we can demonstrate where our beliefs have taken us. For instance, Tesla.
Maybe I have to slow down, you know. I haven't been in New York for a long time. Just slow down there.
For instance, Tesla, he thought about electricity, and he produced workable models that now give us the kind of electric transmission that we have. Marconi sat down and thought about transmitting sound through the air, and we got radio. But where's the bhakti yogi that can sit down and demonstrate that there is a Lord Brahma, that can show that people can fly to other planets? How can you demonstrate these things? You can't. You're saying that it's testable, that it's repeatable, it's science, but it's all internal as far as I can see. You can't show anything externally that everybody else can see.
The problem is that even though, as your sense perception becomes enhanced in bhakti yoga, even though you could be aware of things that you describe, the bhakti yogi is focused on the ultimate destination. Just like in the beginning of this chapter, Vidura is asking the questions. What did the Prachetas attain? What was their destination? And Vidura, furthermore, embeds in his question that I know they're going back to Godhead, but meanwhile, there must have also been some things they did in this material world before they went back to Godhead. Can you talk about it? So that's possible when you have a lifespan of hundreds of thousands of years. But what do we have these days? We've got a few decades. So therefore, we're focused on the ultimate goal. We're not focused on the development of experience in terms of subtle realms and so on and so forth. We're aiming for the supreme destination. We don't have time to go on the local train. Maharaj.
When Prabhupada was asked that, can you show us a mystic power? Prabhupada pointed out his disciples and said, this is my mystic power. He said, previously they were all addicted to sinful activities, and now they become mad after God.
Yes, when you see Maharaj do his ecstatic dance at the peak of the kirtans, that is mystic power. He does his hot foot number. Remember in Tokyo, when Prabhupada was there, a devotee, it might have been Bhanu Maharaj, our Bhanu Maharaj, asked him the question, have you ever met Indra? And Prabhupada replied, if I have, what's it to you? And if I haven't, what's the loss? Anything else? Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Glories for all of us.